Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never that debt is fraud. We want to continue providing you the input on what's necessary for our Learn Pray Act so that we can be more efficient, efficacious in our efforts. And so it's all about constitutional compliance. We want to continue to help everybody focus that as we include supporting the entire Constitution, we not only fix our problems, but we fix everybody else's problems to help them recognize that uniting on the Constitution is the solution. And I, as much of a cliche that that sounds like, you know, because I always hear, oh, the Constitution is the solution when I was a kid. And like, you're just saying that because they never really understood it. Not that they didn't understand it to some degree. They didn't understand exactly how or what and how, why. Because as I look at it, it was just really one of those nice things to say that, yeah, who can argue with that? But they really didn't have a solution. So all that being said, welcome back, Sean. Welcome back, Tammy. Now, one of the things that, because we just had a conversation about what we were talking about yesterday, and I stand corrected. Now, we talked about the business case of what was happening with the revolution or the spirit of revolution in the Americas. And technically, had the king opened up Parliament, and actually, I think if you really look at the size of Parliament at the time, opening up Parliament to the Americas, they probably would have had to build a bigger building, forcing, you know, an expanse of representation in the Parliament. Now, technically, a lot of people go, oh, well, we don't need to do that. But if you really want to have good representation, because this goes back to what is proper representation? Is a million people properly represented by one person? Heck no. This goes to that fundamental argument at the end of the Constitutional Convention where Washington said, I don't think 40,000 people are adequately represented by one person. Maybe 30,000. That's still a high number if you really think about it. And if you look at New Hampshire, I think New Hampshire is somewhere, it's under 2,000 people to one representative in the state house. Wow. I think they got great representation. You know, the ideal representation is one for one. In other words, you got one person in there, you know, literally taking care of your interest. And what we have today, because our representation has too many people to adequately represent, they're really only in there representing themselves and what's good for them and their career, and which is why we have these problems. I mean, these are the fundamental basics. But getting back to the accuracy, I did the research, and I remember I was looking at sources where the sources basically said it was 0.1%, I believe, on the T-tax. And the sources that I had were looking at, you know, barely 1% of some of the taxes when we looked at the burden of the British tax. Now, Sean went out and looked at that. He goes, wow, that's really low. And he says, no, that's not correct. And actually, Sean, what did you find?
Well, I found actually, I'm not specific on the TX. It undercut the local merchant, the colonial merchants. And that was more of a burden on them.
Yeah.
And
the Stamp Act was one of those types of things.
Most of the taxes, the Navigation Act, which they had imposed, was 10 to 15% on navigating certain areas. The Sugar Act was 10% on molasses. The Stamp Act was 33 to 50% of the retail price of the newspaper or whatever paper you had, periodical, depending on the size.
And so as I understood the Stamp Act was almost like a double-edged sword because there was the tax on the stamp itself, but the person that had the authority to actually stamp the paper was not your friend. it, I believe, was a proprietor that was brought in from England that had the different stamps to charge you and so forth, so that they were basically taking your money and not reinvesting it in the local community, if you understand what I'm saying. This was a new tax collector that was coming to America, and they were kind of, in a weird way, they were anointed or blessed by the crown of being able to be the assessor and the collector of this tax, that they would, you know, carry themselves back into England, and they were getting a stipend off of that. In other words, this was a business for them. It's not like...
like the Roman tax collectors.
Pardon me? Yeah, like the linen tax? Yes.
No, I said like the Roman tax collectors.
Oh, yes, very much so. So that way, the Stamp Act itself created not only just a revenue stream, but a very specific group of people that weren't local. You know, there were different, and Madison talked about this, I think, in his essay on property, where they create a law that says you have to use this kind of linen in a funeral to basically promote and ensure that only that linen is going to be used in all funerals, guaranteeing, you know, a corner on that market. And Madison says, you know, that's an atrocity. Well, this is that kind of same vein where they created these tax collectors that were loyal to Britain, and they wanted to make sure that there was no paper out there, no scripts, nothing, that didn't have a stamp on it. And so these guys, and it was pretty bad, because these guys would report people, and the magistrates at that time, which was basically not the sheriff, it was the local governor or the local judges that the king brought in this was a large warfare effort, and I'll call it lawfare, because they did have their own British troops to go break into your home, search for things, and literally confiscate stuff, and they pocketed all the money on all this stuff. It was a really bad, oppressive system and condition. Again, looking at the macro, America would have taken these things if they only got representation. They were willing to stay a part of the British system if they could only have representation in Parliament.
How much do you think that affected the press?
The newspaper and the press and so forth, because...
yeah, dissemination of perhaps dissent or opinions that were against the crown, and the tax put an extra burden on those people. So
the press...
you know,
so
like the censoring the internet now. You only get one voice out there because they're the only ones that can afford to pay the tax to get their paper out.
Yeah, so the press in those days was the Wild Wild West. Anybody and everybody could do a pamphlet, do a paper, and actually, when you talk about the paper, it was really more of a pamphlet. Now, the big cities and so forth, that's where they produced paper, you know, in the big cities. But in the smaller towns, it was literally more of just small pieces of paper, pamphlets, what have you, just helping you understand what's going on around, you know, the community and outside the state, what have you.
And I would think that the people who were nice to the king and his agenda didn't get as hard a stipend or percentage put on him as someone who might be critical.
Yeah, going back to the Tory Acts, the loyalists were getting advantages because of their loyalty. Right. So the king was dividing and conquering, but when it came to the press, there was still secret press out there. There were still papers that weren't stamped, that weren't being viewed. And that's one of the reasons why the people that they employed from Britain to come out here, some of them were like spies. Some of them were well-trained in, you know, looking and investigating, finding out, you know, where are the secret presses, because it is, Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations talks about what was going on in England in 1776, The Wealth of Nations was written. And he was talking about, is a person really a criminal when taxation is so oppressive that the tax itself is destroying a person's family, their lives, and everything else. So is that person really the crime? Who is the criminal here? Is it the government, or is it the person that is not paying their taxes or doing everything they can to avoid taxation? And so this is where Adam Smith really kind of, you know, helps people see that, you know, it's our job to actually challenge the taxation and those types of things. And he emphasizes in The Wealth of Nations the importance of paying for the government you need to give you the security that you need, not what they need. And so keeping them in check was big. And so here are the framers, that when The Wealth of Nations came to America, this was like awesome. They were reading stuff and they're going, wow, there we go. So that's why it became the Bible of the American experience, or I should say the economic boon under the Constitution of trying to create and actually building a free market system. A free market system, not a capitalist system. Capitalist system is actually where government kind of protects and regulates to protect corporations or the favors and so forth. Capitalism is not a good system. It is better than communism, but a free market system is the only system and the system that our framers actually implemented for markets between the states is to be free market. Markets within the states were left to the states to decide whether they wanted to have a free market or whatever they did, because remember, the federal government couldn't regulate them and do that. But back to the point here, I think that when we look at this concept of taxation and this representation, what it would have cost, I honestly think that this just goes down to that real, the best summary of what was going on. The king made the dumbest business decision he could have made. And so this actually kind of goes back, because I think one of the things that I was going to forget to mention is that when we look at Britain at that point in time of 1776, it was truly a caste system. There were people with privileges and people that had no privileges. There were people that, you know, they were indigent or they were serfs. And then it even had slavery. So there were definitely these different classes. And as a matter of fact, when people thought, and this is interesting because when we look at our framers, they actually shared this paradigm that if they had, you know, slaves, if they had means and capabilities, in other words, they were land-holding freeholders, then they were above those who, you know, were living in shacks, barely getting by, and, you know, had to take on jobs, you know, with the local farms or what have you, so that they could have extra money to do, you know, they didn't go on vacation, so they could put, you know, food in the cupboard for the wintertime, that type of thing, being responsible people. So the framers themselves, they realized, and this is probably how good and righteous they were, they realized that even though those people may be uneducated, they may not be, you know, of privilege, in this new system, they should have the equal right to become a representative as to anybody else. And so they really created a system that opened up opportunity for everybody, unlike the caste system that they were kind of living under, and in some ways, many of them enjoyed. Now, I think in the Constitutional Convention this past year, I don't think, Sean, you read that. That was Tammy and I. And so in going through that, and when we go through it this year, you'll realize that the men that were in the convention, this was the cream of the crop. I mean, these people were given a four-week or four-month hiatus with a stipend from their state government, but they had the affluence, or I should say they already had the financial backing to be able to not be at work tending their plantations, tending their corporations, whatever their business was, they had the ability to do that. So it's not like these people were literally wondering, well, shoot, you know, how am I going to get the crops watered during the summertime? They weren't worried about that. They actually, these people were pretty well affluent. again, I like to use the word cream of the crop. And in so many ways, they were the cream of the crop because in many ways, there was enough prevailing minds in that Constitutional Convention to ensure that they weren't going to implement an oppressive system. They did everything they could to get rid of slavery, and unfortunately, they had to pursue compromise, and the compromises they ended up implementing actually put us on the path of eradicating slavery had we stayed the course. All that being said, as it's easy to, you know, because one of the things that bothered me last night is when I said, you know, there's probably a lot of people in heaven that, you know, are, you know, rolling in their graves because they were really oppressive or what have you. I think I overreached and broad brushed a lot of really good people when we look at how many problems there were, because each state did have their share of problems by running up their currency and behaving badly. Each state did. But the one state that kind of kept the Articles of Confederation guaranteed to fail, no amendment passed, not one of these amendments that we're going through, not one. So that was happening because Rogue Island was apt to destroy the Confederation. They didn't think that in a time of tranquility, people would be willing to give up power. It's kind of like, you know, why would I give up something that I have full control over when I don't see the need for it? Right? It's kind of like, why would somebody, you know, when there's no real threat, why would I cut my arm off? Well, if my arm is trapped between a rock and a, and I'm out in the wilderness and I'm going to be eaten by wildlife in the middle of the night, you know, as soon as the sun goes down, I better cut my arm off so I can get to safety. I mean, those types of things and consequences actually come into your head. Do you have to make those types of decisions just to survive? But nobody does that, you know, because they're trying to create a better system for themselves at that point in time. They got it pretty good. So, folks, keep that in mind. What these men did was they created an environment and a system that gave everybody the equal opportunity to succeed and fail. So, all that being said, I appreciate, Sean, you providing the truth of what you found. I need to go back and figure out where my resources were. But it really comes down to the fact of these taxes. So, one of the things kind of alluded to, because, Sean, I think you were pointing out that I was talking about these 5% taxes, and in contrast to the British taxes, but one of the things, and correct me if I'm wrong, it seemed like the sentiment of the states were they didn't want to pay the debt. I mean, the facts are, the data is that there were some states that were more than happy to pay their debt. But I don't think they were going to jump at the opportunity to say, hey, tax us more. It's just not in the nature of governments and so forth. So, and our people. Hey, you know, I want to buy a car and, you know, I like this car, but can I, you know, whatever, what's the top dollar I can pay for that car? Because I don't mind paying the most for it. That doesn't happen. I mean, everybody wants to pay the least. They want the best deal. So I would think that the human nature is somewhat involved in this whole taxation. But I think that there were states that would have been happy to actually, and that they probably did have. I'd like to probably go and look at how many states actually did ratify some of these amendments. But it seemed like there was one state that never ratified any of the amendments, period, and that was Rhode Island. And so I don't have that data because, you know, we actually do have the data on all the amendments that went out and what states, under the U.S. Constitution, what states had ratified that amendment. And I know that because with the very first amendment of the Bill of Rights that never got ratified, even though it was ratified, because we found out about it late. I think it was just a few years ago. They actually found that in the Connecticut archives, or somebody finally reported that they found this a little while ago, that in the Connecticut archives, they did, the legislature did ratify that first amendment. They did it one at a time. And instead of sending a copy or making a copy and sending it off to the to Congress in New York at that time, because I think that's when the first 2 years they were meeting up in New York. So instead of sending a copy over to New York, actually not up, but over it, over to New York, they just filed it. It somehow just got filed. And they go, hey, hold on here. Because when somebody saw it, they go, we didn't ratify this. Is this legit? They come find out it was a legit ratification. And they never sent it. And but even though they're still holding it. This is the point. Right now, Connecticut is sitting on the one ratification that would get that amendment across the finish line. They've yet to send it to Congress to say, we did ratify this. And so that amendment is the apportionment amendment. That amendment would basically guarantee that Congress, or a representative in Congress, could not represent any more than 50,000 persons. Now, defining persons as electors, or I should say people who could vote, okay, that's far better than a million, isn't it? What do you think, Sean? What do you think, Tammy?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, so why is it that Connecticut is sitting on this and holding it back? Because they are so progressive today. They don't want to improve representation. They know that this, you know, the smaller the cesspool is, the more corruption and crap they can get away with. But anyway, the one thing, folks, because we're actually, this may be one of those shows that we don't get into content. I think we will. But it was brought up, and I want Tammy to kind of bring up the question and the points, because now that we've had some time to digest over the weekend the executive exertion of regime change in Venezuela, how does that jive? And I think, Tammy, I'll let you articulate what you were thinking. We got 2.5 minutes. Go ahead and come up and set the stage, or if you need more time when we come back from the break, the mic is yours.
I mean, if we stick strictly to what is constitutionally compliant, that's what I want to talk about. Like, I want to leave out all the emotions because, you know, you've got every single conservative that I know, almost every single one saying, yeah, this is good because of all of these reasons that they've listed. Well, that doesn't make it constitutionally compliant. Just because, but right. I want to know what your take is on it.
GR's take. Okay, so I don't want to necessarily poison the well because we haven't really talked about this, folks. As a matter of fact, just so you know, Sean always comes up with great ideas. Okay, so let's talk about that during the show. That's a go back. Let's do that. And Sean? Do I open it up so that we actually discuss things? Do I really talk?
Well, I do have a counterpoint.
Go ahead. Well, it's actually, but my point before going into that is you do this all the time, and I always say, do I not always say, let's talk about it in the show. I want to talk about it fresh. I don't want to, you know, go out and have this conversation and then try to do the same thing on the show. So, right?
You do. It's exasperating, but it works out for the best.
Yes, it does. Because I know it's frustrating because you want to talk about it right now. But no,
right, but it's good because these are the conversations that people are having.
Yes.
And the ones that we need to have.
Right. But sometimes if I do talk about it, sometimes we'll cover stuff that we forget to cover when we actually talk about it during the show. Because we already talked about it. We go, well, that problem was resolved and nobody will ever benefit from that. So having the thorough conversation during the show is always best because that way nothing gets left out. Plus, there's this possibility that you or I could pollute the water by throwing some ideas that we may not have thought of. And, you know, then we think about it, and then next thing you know, it literally changes context or so forth. So anyway, we are going into break. Right now, we're going into break. So when we come back, what I'll do is I'll ask Tammy and I'll ask Sean if, you know, they want to place context to how they feel constitutionally about this. Because at this point, we, you don't have James Madison to tell us, you know, tell us everything we need to do. We have to think for ourselves, and I think exercising that thought process is important. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so what I was trying to say is I try to nurture and develop both the knowledge as well as the thinking process, because if you really look at, because I've listened to a lot of different people, and none of them have really looked at the broader picture. And I'll bring that up when we talk, but that's okay. The what's important is on the fundamental understanding of going through both the Constitutional Convention and the ratification debates, was there any implied power for the president to exercise executive privilege with force? Because I think that's what the president, supposedly, that's under this umbrella, that's what he did. And the question is, what was the justification behind it? So these types of things, right? So go ahead, tell me your feelings, or actually what your thoughts are on it, Tammy. And don't worry about it, because as you look at it, we'll see how we peel the onion, because I think that there's some layers here that create a different context regarding the Constitution and how the framers themselves operated. So again, I don't want to poison the well. What are your thoughts?
I mean, my thoughts are that it's not constitutionally compliant, and it alarms me that, you know, a president can go into another country, a sovereign country, and say, oh, okay, now we're taking over until we deem it good enough for you guys to take over again.
Okay.
That's alarming.
Yes. Yes.
If he's going to do it to them, then where does it end? Like,
I understand.
There is no, it obliterates the Constitution.
It obliterates the concept of a limited powers, right? And limited government. Absolutely. And there are barriers and so forth. And I completely understand your position. And Sean, what do you think?
I think that he's within his power as the chief law enforcement officer. He took an oath to uphold the law and execute the law
of the union.
And Maduro was illegitimately taken power.
Uh-huh.
He lost the election and he took power anyway by force. And he was under indictment with the U.S. Justice Department for running and facilitating drug trafficking and other things, other crimes against American citizens, pumping fentanyl into the country, that he's being supplied and empowered by our adversaries. Mm-hmm. They're using him as a satellite to infiltrate our country with, he opens his prisons and sends all of them to our country to destabilize and demoralize and cause chaos in our country.
Mm-hmm.
He's working with our adversaries to chemical warfare against our populace.
Mm-hmm.
And he's illegitimate leader of the country. He was not elected democratically. And Again, he's under indictment in the United States, so they went and captured him and brought him back. And now he's going to serve trial. He's going to get his due process.
Okay, so there are definitely some things you're bringing up that America has a right to protect its interest. When I say its interest under the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
And so, as a matter of fact, so let's, because a lot of people bring some things up, but they don't necessarily bring up, because I haven't heard a full list of all the presidents that have used executive power. The first president to actually exert executive power without Congress, you know, being involved in the decision was Thomas Jefferson with the Barbary Coast or the Barbary Pirates.
About Washington and the Whiskey Rebellion?
Well, so that was internal. That wasn't regime changing, going out to try to change. And to be clear, Jefferson was only protecting our commercial interests of our shipping and so forth. And had he let them get away with picking on ships, flying the American flag, and basically taking our ships, our people, and our goods, had he let that happen, it's only enabling bad behavior. He had to send a message to the Barbary Pirates and the Ottoman Empire that we're not going to take this. You mess with our commerce, you will deal with our wrath. And so he sent a couple ships and the Marines out there. They kicked butt and they brought things back. Now, I've heard somebody try to allude that to that was kind of quasi a regime change, but it wasn't. Not at all. It was literally, I think Thomas Jefferson did the right thing by going out there and protecting our interests and getting our assets back and our people back, ships back, so forth and so on. So that right there is a time and point where the president, in his position as the commander-in-chief, doesn't necessarily have to get Congress to declare war. He can use those resources because of exigencies. Because of the exigencies of the time, where the time is of the essence, we don't have time for Congress to debate this. He's not going to go out and engage in full-fledged warfare. He's only going out to secure that commerce and bring it back. That was it. Now, going into regime change and that type of stuff, that is absolutely unconstitutional. Removing a sitting leader, here's the other thing. Maduro was absolutely replaced, and the world knew that he was now opposing his will against the people. So is that really regime change, or is that the removal of tyranny? There's things that I did not like about what Trump did and how he did it, but some of the things were justifiable for those types of purposes. The point is that I think that the real justifications had far more to do with money and leverage or, America's corporate crimes and those types of things that he was more interested in instead of some of the right things. But let's even look further at this. When America finally got to a point where we kicked British butt in 1814, right, took a little trip. And they basically went home with their tails between their legs, which helped justify and helped actually create a respect where Britain finally started honoring a treaty with the United States. It gave us a leg up. 6 years later, actually, I think it was 8 years later, because I believe the Monroe Doctrine was in James Monroe's inaugural address of his re-election. I can go back because I have the documentation. It's important, but it's not that important. It was definitely the Monroe Doctrine was delivered as a part of either the State of the Union or the inaugural address. This was when he disclosed to the world that anybody, any nation that is not a nation that has interests, in other words, you're not in this Western Hemisphere, don't meddle with nations in this Western Hemisphere. We will not allow it. One of the things that was happening in Venezuela was China and Russia has been meddling in Venezuela and a lot of these other puppet nations. And they're managing and driving warfare in our hemisphere. And I would like to see the Monroe Doctrine actually revitalized completely. I would like to see all of the European, Asian interest removed from the Western Hemisphere, even in America and Canada. Even though Canada may not want it, we've declared that that's our job, that's our position, and I think we need to revitalize that. But in looking at the big picture, there are all sorts of rights, there are all sorts of wrongs, and there are all sorts of ways to get across the finish line. When I look at whether it's constitutional or not, and whether I look at the motive, I think the motive is really the driving factor. When we look at, you know, how Congress tried to assume power with the Department of Transportation and creating these cockamamie justifications and saying, oh, well, it's for common defense and for commerce and this, that, and the other thing. The bottom line is it's not something that is there directly enumerated. America has been doing regime changes and has basically been managing the globalist movement in the world a long time, and we're literally at the brink of collapse because of our involvement in maintaining this direction. And so when we get involved in regime change, whether it be Saddam Hussein or when we get involved in Iran a long time ago, what have you, we should never be doing that. We should, as a matter of fact, our foreign policy should be straight and forthright. Everybody should know. And this should be a constitutional policy. And I would love to see a constitutional amendment to basically say America will never step foot on, you know, any foreign soil other than to fight warfare if necessary to protect our interests, to protect the interests of the union, not the interest of the president, not the interest of the corporations. So bottom line is, I think that if we told the world that we're not going to come die for you because some tyrant is, you know, basically killing you off and killing your neighbors off and everybody else, all you need to do is call out and say, we want to have an honest and open election to decide now whether we move in the direction of liberty or whether we allow these tyrants to rule us. Because Germany could have easily, the people of Germany could have easily sent out the sentiments, you know what, we're not supporting Hitler. But Hitler basically got into their minds and they followed him. And over time, there have been plenty of times where I think Tiananmen Square, where the people of China or the people of Taiwan, the people of Hong Kong, the people of Crimea, Ukraine, there are people that have seen this globalist effect and, you know, how they're, you know, they're just puppets. And we're a part of the puppet mastering. We need to change our position completely and say, if you want our help, you have to basically start moving into a territorial status where you become a state and will start operating as a part of the United States once you've attained the objectives necessary to get there, to where your people can become citizens and so forth. But it's not going to be an overnight thing. But if you want to go in that direction, we will bring military presence and defend you and defend your right to liberty. That is the only constitutional policy that we should have regarding dealing with foreign wars and foreign politics, only if they want to become a part of the United States. And again, it's not this fast ticket that they all of a sudden they get on planes and come to America. No. They have to basically assimilate, and some of those people can go through the naturalization process, possibly, but they can't. Again, we got to go back on what we talked about the other day regarding Islamists and communists and so forth. But I believe that we have a moral responsibility to defend liberty, not regimes. We have a moral responsibility to ensure people have the freedom to choose what they want to eat, what they want to do, whether they want to succeed or fail. The system that we were given under this Constitution, I can't believe that what the UN is doing has been ordained by God, but I can tell you that this Constitution was to ensure that every kindred, tongue, race, culture in the world could have the opportunity to shed, you know, their oppressive ways, their oppressive culture, religion, ideologies, and what have you, and that all people could be free. And when we start communicating that to the world, I think we'll actually start seeing real changes, and that will actually put these evil empires on their heels, because it actually means that if you stand up, we will come and rescue you. We should have gone into China in Tiananmen Square. The only reason we didn't is because China serves a purpose in the globalist agenda. I mean, somebody had to test drive this complete, 15-minute city, control social, what do they call it, social credit, all the crap that they're doing.
Social credit score.
All of this. The globalists needed China and these closed communist systems to get away with, test running this stuff so they could take it and apply it everywhere in the world. If they don't kill us, they still want to have control over us, those who they allow to live. This is a very dark and evil time, a time that only he knew what we would be facing. So, at least that's my
two cents. Not even about killing. They want to kill most of us.
Right.
But they want slaves, too. That's part of their evil agenda.
Right, right. But so
I was just going to say, I don't think that regime change is appropriate because the vice president took over the position of president. The Supreme Court ordered her to assume the role to continue government. So it wasn't like they toppled the regime.
Okay.
They arrested a criminal who happened to be illegitimately assumed leadership of the country.
Yeah.
So that should protect him from criminal prosecution.
So is the vice president
criminals and infiltrators and drugs into our country?
Okay, so let me cut to the chase. Is the vice president the one that was duly elected?
She was elected along with him. So I don't think she was duly elected because he wasn't either.
So the person
that was, see, that's another thing that a lot of people aren't looking at. You look at the history of the election and the stolen election, because I personally don't have any proof of it, but I've seen a lot of proof.
Uh-huh.
And that's where it all came from, is Venezuela. And they built the systems that were used.
It's a small world. But my point is that the argument to say we want to reinstate and reinforce the outcome of the democracy looks like it's kind of fell flat, because it's not
That's what I'm saying. That was never the intention.
Okay.
The intention was to capture a criminal and bring him to justice.
Right. Okay. And
it wasn't regime change, or they would have brought in forces and taken out all the leadership and done the things that were done in the Middle East when that regime change, regime change operations.
Yeah, okay. So in that context alone, the president doesn't have the constitutional authority to enforce, the criminal behavior of another nation for corporate admiralty law and so forth. It's one thing if there were, and so he does have the authority to, they're running warfare with the fentanyl, the drug running, that type of stuff. Absolutely. Protecting our interests, but protecting the global corrupt court system and the corporate, cause there's a lot of oil. Apparently Venezuela owes the world, if not $1 trillion, I mean, an obscene amount of money, or not the world, some global corporations. And so bottom line is, it's not our job to be the cop for these corporations or other nations, period. But we do have the responsibility of protecting our interests and stopping that fentanyl, stopping drug running, coming across, the Gulf of America into the United States. Absolutely. He's got the authority to do that. But again, there were so many things that were wrong, and there are some things that he could have used or done to say, he would have needed Congress to declare war on Venezuela. But we already know that Congress was compromised. So at least firing the boats out, but the point is that there has to be a good context. So I think that I haven't really seen, other than possibly the Monroe Doctrine and going after China, Venezuela, there's things that we can be doing and we should do. But the question is, if the intent was being the cop and enforcing the crimes that were committed against corporations and other nations, what have you. That's really not our constitutional job.
No, but I guess I'm confused because if someone comes here from another country and commits a crime, a drug trafficking, murder, whatever, against an American citizen, they come to this country and harm or cause to be harmed American citizens. Does the president not have the right to pursue them outside the country?
Well, so
the law enforcement, the executive branch.
Okay,
FBI,
so what's the crime? What's the crime?
Justice.
You answer me. What is the crime?
Murder.
Okay, so is murder a crime that the federal government has jurisdiction over?
I'm not sure.
Well, it would be in the Constitution. They've enumerated very specific crimes that they have jurisdiction over.
Okay.
And so that would be treason, piracies committed on the high seas, counterfeiting of the currencies, and laws violated against the laws of nations. So there's basically four crimes that were enumerated. Remember, Thomas Jefferson listed these things, that they can't just create a crime and say, we've got jurisdiction over this. The only other crime that was created they would have had jurisdiction was the movement and production of distilled liquor based on the Prohibition Amendment. But when it came to crime, there's never been an amendment delegating them the authority to enforce any other crime other than this, you know, maintaining and the counterfeiting of our securities and coins and or treason. You know, in other words, an insurrection against the Constitution. So, yeah, when you look at the Whiskey Rebellion and those types of insurrections, that is an insurrection against the Constitution. That's why they charge them with treason. So, but come to murder, drugs and those types of things, even kidnapping, right, wrong, or indifferent, the government just can't assume that it has the ability to define, punish, and, you know, prosecute and enforce laws against certain crimes that they want to enforce, if that makes sense.
What about domestic violence?
All of those, if it's not enumerated, they can't do it. I mean, the Constitution.
But doesn't the government have a responsibility to protect the citizens against invasion and domestic violence?
The federal government's responsibility is to protect the sovereignty of the Union and of the states and the people in a general sense. Each state's responsibility is to basically have cognizance over their crimes and in protecting their people. States are sovereign. They're the ones that have to, you know, they come up with the systems of protecting themselves. And if a state, you know, does a good job, then they do a good job. Some states did bad jobs. Bottom line is the Constitution was constantly justified in the ratification debates that if the power is not delegated to them over those types of crimes, they can't inject themselves. Which is why Madison basically stated in the Virginia ratification debates, when you really look at why a person would have to go into a federal court, it has to arise under that Constitution. They have hardly anything over crime. They have hardly anything over, anything at all regarding contracts, property, those types of things. They can't make laws regarding those things. Therefore, Madison stated that 99% of all cases that people would have to deal with a court system would never see the light of day in a federal court. And that was even before the 11th Amendment. Because again, the premise is, does it arise under the Constitution? Because if it does, they have jurisdiction. If it doesn't, they have no jurisdiction. So there's this noble thing called, you know, well, it's good to have a benevolent leader. But when we really look at the benevolence that the federal government has assumed, they've used all of their benevolence as weapons against us. I mean, shoot, just look at January 6th and supposedly those alleged crimes and so forth.
Exactly.
I think that having a very limited and defined federal government and having robust states and having, because bottom line, the reason we don't have robust states is because the federal government says we're going to do everything for you unconstitutionally. Don't worry, trust us. So they've created a self-licking ice cream cone, and, you know, they're fat and bloated. because
and the hypocrisy just never ends.
Correct.
Because I don't understand how, and I would hope, can you explain or compare, make a comparison? You talked about how Jefferson was justified in what he did with the pirates. How is Trump not justified in what he did with Maduro?
Okay, so those it's, were Americans.
It's basically the same thing, except he went and cut off the head of the snake.
Okay, so
he didn't attack Venezuela. He didn't invade Venezuela. He didn't destroy Venezuela or put them under military invasion. He went in. He grabbed the guy who's under the current laws of the United States. I understand that they might not be constitutional and they don't have the authority to do that.
There
and see,
go.
That's the conundrum.
There
How
go.
Can he use the Constitution and have constitutional compliance in a situation and reality that is totally out of control with overreaching federal power?
Okay, so
he's damned if he does and he's damned if he doesn't.
Does the federal government in the Constitution have the authority to regulate commerce with foreign nations?
No. And they never should have.
Okay, hold on here. Article 1, Section 8, and help me out, what subsection is it? It's called
the Commerce.
The Commerce Clause, absolutely. They have the authority to regulate.
Between states, but...
Okay, but with foreign nations. And when a foreign nation wants to hijack and take our commerce, they have a responsibility. This we've kind of said this before, where I said, you know, the nation, the whole world has benefited off of our assertion of this power in the Constitution of protecting our commerce. And we should have been outright a century ago saying we are only going to protect ships that are carrying our flag. That way the whole world could have this great pirate scene going on and taking everybody's commerce until everybody's willing to pay for what it costs to have, you know, open channels of commerce. We've been willing to carry that burden for ourselves, but if you want to be included in that, then why don't you help pay for that as well? There's a cost to this. And for us to do keeping the lanes of commerce open in the high seas, because even to this day, we're 200 years, and look at all the technology. Even to this day, most commerce flows on ships because it's the cheapest and most effective way of doing it. Look at these behemoths with all these containers. And so the point is why are these nations getting this protection for free? It's one thing we have the responsibility to do it for ourselves, and it's great to be a good neighbor. But bottom line, being a good neighbor to nations that thumb their nose at us. You know, actually, you heard about today, and, you know, this is definitely one of those shows that is not, you know, it's got ephemeral stuff. Today, they've already announced that they're pulling us out of 66 international treaties, agreements, and what have you, because it does not serve the United States or our interests. There you go. Let's actually put on the table that the federal government doesn't even have the authority to create any of those treaties. All of them should go. Our involvement in the entire UN, it should be done with. Anyway, with that, we actually ran out of time. Thank you guys so much for the input and the passion and the feelings with all of this, because a lot of times, you know, that's what gets people involved in the solutions, is because we get so frustrated and so upset and so angry. We have to live on these passions. We don't want to put the fire out. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.